Hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin State Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. We do have a court with class group here, Bigfoot High School. If you could stand up, we'd like to say hi to you. Good group. Wow, we've had a lot of students lately. Helps when it's not snowing and raining and freezing rain out there trying to get here. So, nice to see you all, and Justice Protasevich is available to meet with you after the oral arguments this morning if you have time to stick around. But welcome. It's nice to meet all of you. All right, go ahead and have a seat. First or second case we're calling this morning is 23AP 1140 CR, Wisconsin Department of Corrections, Division of Community Corrections versus Brian Hayes. Could I have your appearances, please? Morning. Good morning. All right. All right, good morning. So the lineup I have is 25 minutes, followed by 15 minutes, 15 minutes, and 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay, with that, let's proceed.
I never had this one.
May it please the court. Good morning, justices. Probation is a privilege. Probation is a privilege. And Keo Sellers lost that privilege with his despicable conduct in this case. I have 2 points for the court. The first is that the Division of Hearings and Appeals did not consider, let alone address, the key non-hearsay DNA evidence, surveillance videos, and related witness testimony that proved Keo Sellers' probation violations by a preponderance of the evidence. The second point is that setting aside the key non-hearsay evidence that DHA ignored, DHA's view of how to treat a victim's testimony in a revocation proceeding was incorrect on the law. There was good cause on this record to show that confronting the victim was not necessary and that her statements could be considered.
Attorney Kosky, with respect to your first point, I thought of that initially. I'm like, why don't they just proceed even on the surveillance issue, right? Because we've got video testimony, we've got someone identifying identifying him. Isn't the problem that no matter what, whether it's the incident involving peeking in the windows or the actual sexual assault itself, you need someone to say that there was non-consent? I mean, isn't that the issue? So regardless of whether the court reviewed this other evidence, they don't have non-consent without something else?
That is the issue. And we believe that consent was proved circumstantially.
Okay, but how?
Well, let's start with the surveillance first. So the fact that it's undisputed that the victims installed surveillance cameras outside her house the day after the attack, and then we have him on camera on those videos later, and he's identified.
Right.
So
where's the non-consent?
People don't install security cameras on their porch after an attack like this if they're consenting to what just happened.
No. I meant, okay, you have to tie him to the crime. I mean, without the victim, you don't get the sexual assault, because the sexual assault needs her to at least describe him. His DNA is irrelevant unless he's actually describe, but I'm just talking about the actual peering into the windows. I don't see how you can get anything without non-consent. You need something.
We believe that it's a circumstantial case of consent on both the sex assault and on the trespass. As I said, there is no way this victim installed those cameras if she had consented to what just happened to her the night before.
Counsel,
there's no way.
But talk about
we've got a standard review question here. So suppose that could be shown through circumstantial evidence. Why didn't the fact finder reasonably find otherwise? And I'm concerned with some of the arguments that you presented, which seem to have us doing a more exacting review rather than defer to a finder of fact. And so even if you're right, why do you win? Even if you're right that one could find circumstantial evidence of a lack of consent, why isn't it still affirmed based on the standard of review?
So the standard of review here, as the court knows, we're looking to whether DHA's decision was correct. So
right.
Reviewing that decision.
Right.
Interestingly, though, when courts, in particular the Simpson case, have looked at this kind of review, it recognized in the Simpson case and throughout that it was looking at what the ALJ did with regard to the facts. And if you look at paragraph 30 of the Simpson case, it in fact said that it wasn't, that there was harmless error for the ALJ to not find good cause. So to say that we look only to DHA's decision in these cases would be wrong. And it's specifically wrong in this case because DHA ignored the key evidence. There is no mention in the 5-page DHA decision of the key evidence that the ALJ said resulted in these violations being proved by preponderance of the evidence. That the evidence wasn't mentioned.
Just going back to the standard review, though, I understand that the ALJ is the one who is making sort of the decision about testimony and those sorts of things. But we do defer to DHA, and here there's a determination that there wasn't enough here to show consent. Why isn't that something that we would... Why isn't that a determination where that we would defer to?
The court defers to findings of fact. There were no findings made on this evidence. It was ignored. The evidence was ignored. You can't defer to something that's not there.
Well, we don't usually require fact finders when we're reviewing their determinations to lay out every piece of evidence and give their determination on it. I'm just talking in general that there clearly was a thoughtful review of the record. I understand you didn't feel like that Mr. Hayes took into account of information that would weigh strongly for that. And whether I would have made the same decision as him, I can sympathize with your argument on that. But I'm not the decision maker, and he is. So our question seems to me to be a different one, where we need to make sure we stay in our lane and don't superimpose our own judgment upon the record.
I want to be clear that the state and DOC are not asking for the court to change any standards. I think there's some debate in the briefs about whether we are. We want the court to keep the same substantial evidence standard in place, but to clarify that the substantial evidence standard isn't met when the key evidence is completely ignored. So you can't have substantial evidence deference when you have the ALJ saying, I want to point out that the ALJ, again, we're not reviewing the ALJ's decision, but the ALJ said that the DNA showed that it was Sellers. How did that DNA get on her body? How did the DNA get on her body? So the ALJ said that, and then we have DHA just ignoring it. The DHA doesn't even comment
on it. I understand what the DNA results were, but they aren't the typical DNA results that we see. The DNA evidence isn't as strong as I frequently see in criminal cases. Can you explain that?
Well, first of all, you make a great point and segue to this is not a criminal case. As we pointed out, the standard here is proving these allegations by a preponderance of the evidence.
I understand that. I want to know what happened with that DNA, if you know the answer.
And what do you mean, what happened?
I mean, I'm used to DNA results being 1 in 1 billion, not your brief said that the DNA found on KAB matches the DNA of 289 other African-American men in Milwaukee. The Court of Appeals said you added and did their math incorrectly, and the real number is 389. I don't really want to split hairs on that, but is this touch DNA? I mean, tell me more about the DNA.
It's not touch, so it's not. It's YSTR DNA, so that would be the type of DNA that looks at the Y chromosome and looks at only, it would not be able to give an individualized match like what you're talking about to a certainty of 1 to 1 billion or something like that. So the record does, and the DNA analyst Michelle Burns did testify at length about the difference between YSTR DNA and the type of DNA most people are familiar with that they'd see on TV. So I do acknowledge that it is 1 in 278 African Americans. African-American males, I believe, or African-Americans. So we believe that in a criminal case, maybe you'd have a point. But in this case, first of all, how did the DNA get there? And then we think that that is sufficient to show by a preponderance of evidence that this was him. So we're not talking about a criminal
him,
case.
Going back to Justice Dallas' point, you still have the consent element.
You still have the consent element. So I'll get to the consent element as to the DNA evidence. Why would this victim have gone to get a rape kit almost immediately after the incident if there was consent? There wouldn't be consent. There's no way that she consented to this sexual assault if she went to police, called police almost immediately, and got a rape kit. There's no consent.
She submitted to a sexual assault nurse exam.
Correct.
Can we talk a minute about the consent to the trespass? Because you were talking about that, and I want to make sure I understand the facts of this case. My understanding is that she reported she was sexually assaulted. She then got the video camera, and then the trespass happened.
Yes.
Okay. So Justice Dallet asked you a question about non-consent, and your answer focused on the video camera, which I understand in relation to the sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
What is the evidence of non-consent then for the trespass?
So we have the fact that she called police almost immediately after the video camera recording occurred on September 21st and 22nd. I'm not sure which it is, but it's late at night. There is a partial police report in the record, and I get a cite for that if you want it. But this police report was submitted by Attorney Rausch, who was Sellers' attorney at the revocation. She submitted a partial police report for when the victim, KAB, called police on that night. So, again, why would she be calling police that night and reporting that her security camera alerted to this man trespassing? Or she didn't say the word trespass, I don't think, in the report. But, again, circumstantially, we have this police report in the record. We have her calling the police right after the video cameras alerted that there was someone there. So why would she be doing that if she was consenting to the person being there? She didn't consent to it.
Let me ask you another question. Why are we here? and I'm asking that because you have you had revocation proceedings, and then you had a trial, right? In August of it was like August 6th to 8th, I think, of 2024.
Yes.
So just this past summer, he was convicted.
Yes.
And he has since been sentenced, I understand.
Yes.
Which is in the public record. You have now more than you would possibly need. You meaning DOC has more than it would possibly need to revoke him, given the fact that he has now been convicted. It was a jury trial, 12 jurors, unanimously, beyond a reasonable doubt.
The victim testified.
Okay, highest standard, confrontation, everything's taken care of. Why not just go back and say, here's a judgment of conviction, now he should be revoked?
So the only thing that's holding jurisdiction over him currently is this case right now. So he would be discharged otherwise. And so on June 17th, 2022, when Hayes' decision came down saying that he wasn't going to be revoked, that was an order saying he's done. He's off of supervision. So we can't supervise him right now except for this Supreme Court case.
According to public record, he was sentenced to prison for 30 years.
35.
Oh, okay, so I think DOC has jurisdiction over him for quite a while.
Well, jurisdiction in which case, though? So jurisdiction in the criminal case because he's now sentenced in that case, or jurisdiction over him to supervise him in the probation case?
You know, look, I mean, we can talk, like, philosophically about who has the jurisdiction over him at this point. The point is, he's not going anywhere. He's in the Wisconsin State Prison System for 30 years, and I don't even know if that's the time.
Owes the state some more time.
Okay, right. But again, like, why are we here? Fine. Like, if this is the only thing that's holding him on this case, what difference does it make? He's in prison. I still am not understanding why you can't go back to to THA with the judgment and conviction and say, now I've got new evidence.
Once he discharges, we can't.
You can't go back?
Can't go back. And I mean, Hayes has a footnote in his brief that says, it doesn't make it absolutely clear that you can. He says that he thinks that it would be possible to reopen that case, but once it's discharged, you can't. So he owes the state some more time.
We're going to be asking you guys about that in a minute, FYI. Okay.
So anyway, it is a footnote in Hayes' brief. He cites a number of cases. Mm-hmm. I don't address it in my reply because I read those cases. I don't think they say exactly what Hayes says. So I don't want to distract the court from very important questions in this case. But I understand, Justice Crofts, what you're saying is, why are we here today? Why shouldn't we get rid of this case? He's already been penalized.
Right, I guess I did say that.
So he owes the state the time for the revocation in that case, one way or another. That's our position. And we think that it was proper to revoke him on the evidence that was before the ALJ and before DHA. DHA just didn't consider that evidence. Now, I want to turn to the second main issue in the case, because it's a really, I think, interesting and important issue. This court hasn't addressed it for decades. The Schmidt case from Harris versus Schmidt from 1975 is the last time the court addressed something like this. And I already mentioned Simpson. That's a 2002 Court of Appeals case. And what I'm talking about is the Morrissey good cause standard. And Simpson itself in its fourth footnote says, really, the Schmidt case is the only time we've addressed this. So as to that Morrissey, what does good cause mean to excuse the confrontation of the victim? This court is going to have to say something about that, we think. It hasn't said anything about it for decades. We think on this record, there was good cause shown.
What do you want us to, what would you have us say about good cause?
Well,
the victims don't need to testify. All the state has to do is assert that it would be traumatic to the victim.
Well, we think that's important. We think that's very important to say in this case, that when it is traumatic to the victim to come testify and she can't 100% identify her masked assailant who was raping her. We
Isn't
think that
the, more the reason why she should have to come testify when she can't 100% identify, so that can be part of the record? Like, isn't that go against
it
your
It could be.
Idea?
It could be. Yes, it could be. But we think it's important for the court to point out that, yes, this is a special case. It involves a victim with a masked assailant who she could not 100% identify. So we think it's important that that good cause standard has to take that into account. The other thing we want the court to say about good cause is the point that when there's other corroborating evidence in the record, that has to be considered. And when you're considering whether there's good cause for the victim not testifying and being confronted.
Yeah, but I guess the issue that I'm having with it is the probation officer didn't even indicate whether she talked to the victim, right? She basically just said, we don't want to re-traumatize the victim. And, of course, she talked about the lack of a positive 100% ID. But she didn't say, we talked to the victim, and this is what it's going to do to her. She doesn't want to come here today. We don't even know if she talked to the victim.
She did say she talked to the victim, but she said that she was told by the victim that she couldn't 100% identify her attacker. Therefore, she didn't want to
Well, she didn't talk about the traumatization. At least as I read it, wasn't relayed to the ALJ in such a way that I have reason to believe that the victim reported that she didn't want to come and testify because she feared she'd be traumatized.
That is correct. That was not said to the ALJ. And I think that another interesting part of the record is at the kind of the closing argument part of the record, Attorney Rausch for Sellers says a comment, it's kind of offhand, but I found it important. She says, and I understand why you didn't have the victim here today. So that kind of leads me to a point about waiver. I mean, they didn't even raise these issues. Seller didn't raise these issues with DHA at all. He didn't bring up the same claims. We pointed out in a brief the claims he did raise, and he raised claims like you had brought up, Justice Protasevich, about the sufficiency of the DNA. But he didn't bring up anything about the good cause standard or the victim not testifying. And in fact, his counsel in the closing argument said, I think I understand why we didn't have the victim here today. So we think that there's a potential waiver issue buried in here too.
For forfeiture.
Waiver or forfeiture. I think it's actually forfeiture.
Mr. Koski, can we go, I want to go back and I want to make sure that I completely understand what it is you want us to do as far as developing the law. You started out and you started talking about Morrissey and the good cause finding, okay? Mm-hmm. And you said there should be good cause, and I'm not sure if you're asking us to make this a holding in the case. When there is a masked assailant, like what is it that you want us to do? And I'll tell you what I'm looking at here is I'm looking at paragraph 20 of Simpson, which talks about you find Simpson, I'll find my glasses.
While you're
the
saying,
go ahead.
I want to say, so I actually, paragraph 20 is quoted a lot in my opponent's brief. I think paragraph 21 is the important paragraph and what I would like the court to say. Simpson at 21, quote, "The more reliable the proffered evidence is, the less necessary it would be for the state to show that obtaining a witness's live testimony would be difficult."
Doesn't that cut against you here?
I don't think
so. You don't have great evidence. I mean, without the victim's testimony, you have a potential that almost 300 black male men in Milwaukee could have committed this. You don't, I mean, that's what you have, and you've got, the potential with the trespass the next day, and that was identified, but you have a victim saying she can't identify the assailant. I don't think that helps you, that paragraph.
Well, the DNA is on her body. She asked for a sane exam the next day, and then she installed a security camera, and then the person came back and trespassed on her porch, and he was identified by the probation agent.
Making a leap there about the person coming back, but okay.
Well, but the probation agent identified him to a 99% certainty.
And it is, so, as did his wife. His former wife.
Well, but that is hearsay. But the probation agent testifying is not hearsay.
No, I understand that. The person on the porch was him. I think you can get that, but the connection you have to the assault, if you're really weighing it, and you really want us to say, what's said in Simpson, that we weigh it, seems to me there needs to be a little something more here, or good cause, which you're asking us, again, we go back to that point, to just not even have something in the record saying why this victim can't show up, that probation officer has to say is, it will be re-traumatizing. That seems like a pretty minimal thing.
I think we're here because it's very important for the court to decide if it's going to adopt the Simpson test and what the Simpson court laid out.
I want to go back to that.
Yeah.
I understand your point on paragraph 21 in Simpson. But 21, not to state the obvious, but it comes after 20, okay? And in 20 is, and I say that because 20 is where they set out the balancing test. And then 21 gets to what you said, okay? So are you asking us, because Simpson dealt with a child sexual assault victim, right? And I think we would all agree that brings its own challenges for victims in revocation hearings and everything else. But what it says in 20, I don't know if you agree with this or not, and I'm trying to figure out what it is you want us, what you are asking us to do. So what it says in 20 is that courts, a good cause should generally be based upon a balancing of the need of the probationer in cross-examining the witness, it's on one hand, and the interest of the state in denying confrontation, including consideration of the reliability of the evidence and the difficulty, expense, or other barriers to obtaining live testimony. And there is an or there, right? So you don't even need the language in 21, depending on what else you have, if it's a difficulty or an expense, or you can show some other barrier. Mm-hmm. Is that what you are asking us
We are definitely saying that Simpson is still good law, and that the court needs to say whether it agrees with Simpson, because it just hasn't said that.
Right, it's
so it needs to say whether it agrees with the tests in Simpson. And Simpson, again, has two different ways you could get there. One is through meets the rules of evidence. Another is through this balancing test that Justice Karofsky just talked about. But it shouldn't be forgotten that the more reliable the proffered evidence is, the less necessary it would be for the state to show. So here, not every case is going to have this DNA evidence. Not every case is going to have the guy caught red-handed on video on the porch. Not every case is going to be like that. This is a perfect case to apply that next paragraph of Simpson, number 21, and talk about how the evidence is more reliable here. So I think that our position is that we think that the evidence that the ALJ had and talked about was good enough to prove this case, and that was non-hearsay evidence. Then we get to the more complicated part of the case, which is the good cause stuff. and the Morrissey standard. And what does that mean? The Supreme Court didn't really say much. All they said was good cause. And then our courts in Wisconsin haven't really said much about it. So this is a very important case. That's why we think that although there may be concerns, and you might ask my opponents about why are we here today and things like that, this court needs to write on these issues in this case. That's why we're here. That's why we took the unusual step of filing this case. We don't file a lot of, DOC does not file a lot of cases against Brian Hayes. I can't even think of another one. Okay, so this is an important case, and the court needs to say what it thinks the law is with regard to a victim like this not testifying and the use of her statements in this case.
If you are, you're putting a lot of weight in the reliability of the proffered evidence, right?
Yes.
In the words in paragraph 21 of Simpson. And I think your argument for the trespass is quite strong. I can see a few more holes in the sexual assault. Why not just lead with that foot? I mean, why say we need to go all in on both of these charges? Because he would probably be revoked from probation on that trespass, right?
We would hope so.
Right. I mean, I think to the extent that there's some concern, it's because those DNA numbers are not what we're used to. He was masked, which unfortunately, right? I mean, people mask themselves so that they can't be caught. I mean, it's right? You don't want someone to get away with doing that, but it does obviously make them harder ID. It just seems like if you're relying so heavily on how strong the evidence is, that second incident is a lot stronger. You agree with that, I guess.
I agree with that, okay. Yes. I think that it's more difficult, but we think it's still sufficient. What was put in before the ALJ, asked the best question, which is, how did the DNA get there? And then everything that led after, or that occurred after it, showed non-consent. See, my light is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I have three topics that I would like to discuss today. First, I'll explain why the administrator's decision sufficiently explains his reasoning and why the DOC's demands for more detail are incompatible with existing law and with the efficient functioning of the...
Can I ask, who's going to address the forfeiture argument?
The forfeiture argument, I'm sorry.
That counsel should have objected or done something to preserve the record and say she should testify instead of saying, I understand why she's not here.
I think that's more properly for Mr. Sellers' counsel, as it doesn't apply to my client.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
Second, I'll explain how and why the constitutionally permissible evidence in this case supports the administrator's decision not to revoke Mr. Sellers' probation. And finally, given the splittage of time, although Mr. Driggett will be handling the bulk of the argument on the good cause standard, I would like to briefly rebut the DOC's unsupported argument in its briefs that affirming the administrator will negatively impact victims of crime. So I first want to address this argument that the Department of Corrections is making that the administrator did not address specific items of evidence, and that this means that he must be reversed. And that means that he didn't consider it, which means that he must be reversed. Because that argument is not based in either fact or law applicable to this case. First of all, the administrator's decision does say in the first paragraph that he conducted a de novo review of the evidence. So we do have an indication that he reviewed the record in the case. Second, there's just no requirement, Justice Hagedorn's point, there's no requirement that he address every single piece of potentially relevant evidence. His decision did what it needed to do. And I'm going to quote here from a case, State X. Rel. Harris versus Annuity and Pension Board. It was a 1979 case from this court, 87 with second 646, where they say, there is no requirement that the administrative agency indulge in the elaborate opinion procedure of an appellate court. It is sufficient if the findings of fact and conclusions of law are specific enough to inform the parties and the courts on appeal of the basis of the decision. And we absolutely have that here in the administrator's decision. We have a paragraph in which he explains that without relying on the hearsay evidence of the victim, which he couldn't do without violating Mr. Sellers' constitutional rights, that the rest of the evidence didn't prove the DOC's allegations. And based on that factual finding and correctly applying the principles of law from Morrissey, he concluded that revocation was not warranted. That's all that he needed to do in his decision, and he did it. The DOC has not cited any case or any authority to support this argument that they continue to make, that the administrator didn't consider certain evidence and that means that he must be overturned. And, in fact, that is inconsistent with the substantial evidence standard on certiorari review of these agency decisions. Because when a court is applying a substantial evidence standard, it's actually not asking if the administrator discussed every piece of evidence or even if he considered every piece of evidence. The question on certiorari review is, does the substantial evidence support the administrator's decision? And if it does, it must be affirmed, even if it could support other outcomes.
Counsel, when we're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, and that is the one of the components of our standard of review, whether the evidence was sufficient that the administrator might reasonably make the determination that he did, I don't disagree with you that there has to be an itemization of each element or each piece of evidence. However, there wasn't mention of what I consider to be kind of key, crucial evidence. So are you suggesting that there is a complete discretion to completely ignore evidence that is really compelling as long as the administrator says he looked at everything?
I don't think that's exactly our position, Your Honor. It is our position that the administrator did not ignore evidence. But the potential error that could come from ignoring truly dispositive evidence, the consideration of that is baked into the certiorari review standard. So if the substantial evidence supports his decision, it must be affirmed. It's, of course, hypothetically possible that there could be a case where an administrator or a decision maker overlooked evidence that made his decision completely impossible for a reasonable person to reach. That's just not this case.
That's where I kind of am, though, so let's talk about that. We have DNA evidence, and I think your friend on the other side has acknowledged it's circumstantial evidence, but that doesn't mean we discount it. Yes, it could have been the DNA of, I don't remember the exact number, is it 287 other black men in Milwaukee, right? But there's no video evidence of any other black man on her porch, is there?
Not that's part of the record, except, Your Honor, that it's not necessarily conclusively proven who the person on the porch is.
Okay. But that's for the fact finder, but we have the probation agent testifying that's him, right?
Yes.
And we have the other evidence that she reported the sexual assault to the police and was examined immediately thereafter. And the next day she put up the video cameras that ended up recording him at her home the next day, right?
The only thing about that evidence, Your Honor, is that it is based on the hearsay statements of the victim. And Mr. Driggett may have more to say about this later, but I don't believe that circumstantial evidence could have been properly considered.
Well, you can consider out-of-court statements, right, without her testimony. There are numerous exceptions under the hearsay rule that would enable the tribunal to consider that evidence.
That's not the decision the administrator reached, Justice Bradley. The administrator determined, and this is laid out in his decision, that there were no applicable hearsay exceptions that could permit him to consider the testimony of the victim in this case.
And we get to determine whether he made that correct determination under the law. That's a legal determination, correct?
Well, Sure. Applied to the, I mean, how he applies it to the facts generally receives a lot of deference in these cases, Your Honor.
Are you done, Justice Bradley?
Go ahead, Justice Karofsky.
Thank you. I want to talk about why we're here. And so I'm looking at footnote 3 on page 36 of your brief, where you say that Mr. Sellers was ultimately convicted of second-degree sexual assault and burglary. A subsequent conviction could form the basis for DOC to file a motion for a new probation revocation hearing. And then you cite a couple of cases, and then you also cite State X. Charles Flowers. A judgment of conviction generally satisfies the standard to reopen a revocation hearing and obtain revocation. I asked Mr. Kusky on the other side what he thought about this. He wasn't really sure that this was an avenue that this case could proceed. I'm not understanding exactly why not, and so I'm wondering if you could elaborate on footnote 3 in your brief.
Your Honor, I'm afraid I do not have much to add on footnote 3. It is my understanding that a judgment of conviction can serve as grounds to reopen obtain a probation revocation.
Even at this stage of this case, because that's what I understood him to say, that because of where we are in this case, at this stage, that this would not apply. You disagree?
I'm not 100% sure, as it was not raised in the brief. I'm not prepared to address that today. I would be happy to submit additional briefing on that question if the court would like.
Wouldn't it depend on what this court decides, if the case is open or closed?
Very possibly, Your Honor.
Counsel, one of the things your friend on the other side said is we should, say something about Simpson, whether we adopt that standard or not, since we've never said anything about it. I'm not sure if that's a phrase he used, but I'm not sure that in any of the briefing anybody was arguing about whether that was the governing standard here or that we should adopt a different standard. I mean, this isn't an issue that SCOTUS has maybe revisited any time recently either, but I just don't know that we have it in front of us. So I'm curious if you have a position on that. I mean, generally speaking, if there's a governing law that's published, we would usually apply it unless somebody is, challenging it in some way.
We do believe the Simpson standard is currently good law, Your Honor. I've not understood Mr. Kosky to be challenging that. I'm sorry, was there more to your question?
Well, I guess he was just wanting us to say some things about it, and I guess I just wasn't sure what it seems that part of the question in front of us is did Mr. Hayes reasonably conclude, that it was applied correctly? But beyond that, I'm not sure what else we would say. And I guess I'm curious what your thoughts would be on that, if anything.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. So we do think that the Simpson case currently lays out a workable formula for determining if good cause exists to excuse a victim from testifying, which, to be clear, when that determination is made, it means that the decision maker is overriding the limited constitutional rights of the accused. But we do think that Simpson has a workable standard. We're not convinced that it's necessary for the court to change it in any way.
And is it your position that we need to conclude that Mr. Hayes made the correct decision regarding excluding the evidence, or that there was no good cause found, or that that was a reasonable application of Simpson or some other standard? How should we look at that?
Your Honor, we do believe that the administrator correctly applied the proper legal principles and that the court that he basis. The standard is it's an arbitrary and capricious standard on these certiorari review cases. So the question is, did he make a decision that was his judgment and not his will? Did he apply the proper legal standards and consider the facts? And we believe that he did so. And to the extent that we're hearing argument that the standard should be differently applied, that's not clear in the law by any means. These are heavily fact-dependent cases, and so this is also heavily tied into the substantial evidence test of whether he made a decision that a reasonable person could reasonably have made based on the evidence, which we think it's absolutely clear that he did. And I would like to talk about that a little more.
You believe the victim had to testify here. Is that right?
We believe the victim had to either testify or have her statements brought in a way that did not violate the rights of the accused.
Due process rights.
Correct. He has a limited due process right. He has a right to the minimum requirements of due process in these hearings.
Because in confrontation, what would have been introduced?
Pardon?
In the cross-examination, what questions would have been asked and answered that are missing from the record?
Of the victim?
Yeah.
Well, that I don't know, Your Honor. And to be clear, it's not impossible to bring in hearsay of a victim. It's just that the DOC does have to clear this good cause bar, which is not especially high. And again, that's more Mr. Driggett's bailiwick today. But our position is that they did not do it in this case.
What would they have needed to have done?
To clear the good cause bar? Mm-hmm. So I believe this was discussed earlier, but the statement that was made by the DOC agent was just that because the victim could not identify her assailant, the DOC agent felt it was not necessary to bring her in and re-traumatize her. But there was no statement specific to this victim. And so if what happened in this case was enough, it would open a giant loophole in the rights of the accused that any victim of not just sexual assault but really any sensitive crime could just be automatically excused from testifying in these proceedings, and that just can't be right. So we think there had to be some sort of specific mention to demonstrate a barrier, because that's the standard, right? It's the DOC has to show that there's a difficulty, expense, or other barrier.
Do you think if someone would be re-traumatized, that would be good cause not to have to testify in these hearings?
I think it's not impossible, but I think the record in this case does not support that assumption.
But the record is
not impossible. Yep. I'm not sure I understood her answer. Sorry, Chief. I just want to make sure I totally. My question to you is, do you think that if it would re-traumatize someone, that would be good cause? And your answer was that's not impossible, and I'm not exactly sure. Can you rephrase your answer? I'm not sure I understood what you said.
Sure. So to show good cause, they have to, it's a balance, right? They have to show that there is my red light is on. May I
go ahead?
May I finish?
You may finish.
Okay. They have to show that there is a difficulty, expense, or other barrier to the victim testifying. So if there were specific evidence to a victim that it would re-traumatize them, that they did not want to appear, that could fulfill that first part of the good cause standard of showing a barrier.
What can I follow up, Chief?
And
please,
briefly.
Just finish my
course.
Thought? And then that gets balanced against the constitutional rights of the accused. And it's whether that difficulty that the state is experiencing should outweigh the right of the accused, which is limited. But without having specific facts, I can't say exactly what would have been needed to demonstrate good cause.
Okay. And I guess my question is, when I read difficulty and I read barrier to obtaining live testimony, and I think about the word re-traumatization, I feel like that fits those two exceptions as outlined in paragraph 20 of Simpson. And so I'm not sure what else you would need.
And, Your Honor, I think that just, if that is the rule, it's just too broad an exception, because we know that probationers do have this constitutional right to confront adverse witnesses. And so if the DOC can get out of that any time there's a victim of a sensitive crime with no facts specific to that victim, that just obliterates the rights that have existed for 50 years since Morrissey from our U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, does it give rights to victims, which they constitutionally have in this state, not to be re-traumatized? I mean, that's the other balance here, right? That has pretty much been ignored.
I do understand your concern. However, this is not a victim's rights case, in large part because, again, there is just nothing in the record to suggest that this victim specifically was asked if she wanted to appear, had specific concerns about appearing. We just heard that she did testify at a later proceeding.
Well, okay, hold on. Okay. It is way different testifying in a probation revocation hearing when it's very close to the date of the assault, where maybe you haven't had all of the support and the services that you would need. In a trial that has months, happens months later, when you have the help of a victim witness coordinator, maybe other advocates, I mean, those are different. And so I'm going to take issue with that. But I understand what you're saying. So what I want to know, like, if it wouldn't have been enough. It wasn't enough for DOC to say it would re-traumatize her. We needed something more here. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
But we don't know what that is. I mean, do you need to know that she's suffering from PTSD, that she's having flashbacks, that she's going to cry when she sees him, that her wounds haven't healed, that she's terrified of this person? Like, what do we need?
Your Honor, these cases are so fact-dependent. I don't think I can say right now what, you know, that there would be any specific magic words. But I can say that what we have in this case was clearly not enough and that the bar cannot be that low.
Thank you, Chief.
All right. Thank you. Second half of the presentation.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm going to shift direction and talk a little bit about Simpson and the contours of good cause in Wisconsin for excluding Platt testimony.
Can we start out with forfeiture a little bit? The objection seems to be she had to be there in person to testify, and his, not confrontation, but sort of confrontation/due process, rights were violated because she wasn't there to be cross-examined, right? So had there been some sort of objection, perhaps that could have been highlighted. Maybe something could have been done to address that more thoroughly, and then we'd have a different potential record here before us on that issue. Why wasn't that forfeited?
Well, I kind of have to go from memory here because this was an issue in the Court of Appeals that was, I'd refer you back to the DOC's brief in the Court of Appeals, and I addressed this in my reply brief. The Court of Appeals says that it's the agency's decision that's being appealed, and the agency, on its own initiative, looked out for the due process rights of Mr. Sellers. They did this on their own, and I don't think that's unusual. Among the list of rights in a due process rights for revocation listed, Morrissey is things like disclosure of evidence at a neutral hearing body, and I think it's the agency's place to proactively make sure those things.
But it's not the responsibility to introduce every possible piece of evidence in the most thorough manner. I mean, part of advocacy involves, hey, I think you're missing something big here, and I want to cross-examine this person, and here's the testimony I want to adduce in that cross-examination. So you need to present it. Then perhaps we'd have a record here that would say, well, here are all the reasons why we aren't going to do that, or maybe they'd make a different decision or some sort of something. But the testimony regarding her also is pretty advantageous, isn't it, to the defendant here? I mean, the state says, and it's in the record, that she wouldn't have identified him. I mean, maybe had she shown up, she would have identified him. So maybe that was a judgment call to say, I really don't want to push on this issue too much. I really don't want her to come. Right now I have a non-identification.
Well, that's right. And also, if she would have appeared, her testimony was also valuable in that she might have excluded him. There were a number of questions that could have been asked that may have made it more or less likely that that Mr. Sellers was the right suspect.
Part of what bothers me, I guess, is we want to have the best possible hearing, and issues related to that hearing come up at the hearing. So it's addressed once, not, you know, on Monday morning after you're looking back and you're saying, you know what, now we lost it or we won it or whatever. I wish this testimony would have been there, so now I'm going to say that should have been presented. That's the logic of objecting, so that things can be dealt with at that time and not later after you win or lose and are sort of evaluating and arguing that something should have been there that wasn't. I mean, that's kind of endless, isn't it?
Well, I see your point. But in this case, I guess I just ask you to remember that this is an internal agency matter. The ALJ's decision is reviewed de novo by the administrator, and I'm not aware of a system of forfeiture rules in revocation hearings that have been well established in Wisconsin.
Yeah. I just, you're not asking for a rule where victims have to testify in every case or else later that hearing can be subjected to the arguments here.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd remind you that this wasn't a certiorari filed by Mr. Sellers. The administrator, in the course of the agency's decision-making, stepped in and made this decision on his own. It wasn't Mr. Sellers who raised his hand and said this wasn't fair. But no, I wouldn't say that the victim always has to testify. That's the purpose of the good cause determination. Good cause in Wisconsin under Simpson is a two-prong test. The easier of the two prongs probably is the presence of an existing exception to the hearsay rule that would allow the proffered hearsay evidence in an adversarial trial. DOC argues in this case that the hearsay evidence should have been acceptable under the residual hearsay rule that was applied in Simpson. They also cite Harris v. Schmidt from the 70s, a case where there was a broader understanding of the excited utterance exception when applied to very young children. And that's an opinion. I have no position on it. That's what the law should be. The fact is that's not what the law is right now. Those were cases that were decided in Simpson's case under the residual hearsay rule because this court had applied that years earlier under Sorensen, and it was already an exception that was available in trial courts. Likewise, in Schmidt, the broader understanding of excited utterance for very young children, Schmidt cites three cases, I think, showing that that was already an established rule available to trial courts. As far as I know, in Wisconsin, there have been no exceptions to the hearsay rule that are crafted out solely for revocation hearings. The first part of the Simpson test is a very simple, objective, yes or no question. If there's an existing hearing rule, if there's an existing hearsay exception, then the hearsay evidence is always subject to good cause.
Simpson says, or at least suggests, but I'm going to say it says, that hearsay is sufficient to prove a probation violation so long as the hearsay is reliable. And the argument that is being made on the other side is that there are sufficient guarantees of reliability here because of the other circumstantial evidence, which was not discussed by the administrator in this case, and that is the DNA evidence that points to your client as the perpetrator of the sexual assault, the video evidence that was obtained shortly after, I don't remember if it was a day or a week, but after the assault happened, that shows that your client was peeping into her windows, which was consistent with her statement to the police that he told her he was doing this while he was sexually assaulting her. He told her that he had been by her house or maybe even in her house. So to me, that lends a lot of credibility, reliability to the out-of-court statement. And my second question for you is on the good cause. Is it accurate, as your counsel on the other side, your friend on the other side has said, that that counsel, I don't know if it was you or some other counsel, at the hearing acknowledged an understanding of why the victim was not at the hearing?
That was not me. Attorney Roush handled the revocation hearing, and I remember that from the transcript. I don't know if she was saying, I understand and I agree with why you didn't call the witness, or if she's just saying she understands your motives for not calling the witness.
Don't you think it's kind of an interesting dichotomy to say you have a strict application of the rules of hearsay and the rules of evidence and their application and the findings that need to be made and good cause findings, but there's no requirement to object to that evidence and preserve sort of the objection so that it can be addressed at the time?
Well, I see the appeal to that approach, but in this case, like I said a moment ago, it was the division who stepped in and proactively protected a due process right that was the division's always at issue.
You can appreciate our frustration up here, though, because we asked other counsel on your side, help us with this forfeiture issue. She said you're the one to tell us about the forfeiture issue. The Chief Justice is trying to figure out the forfeiture issue. And it's sort of like, and so this is, I mean, look, these hearings now, it used to be that the victim had to come in and testify in a room that's like the size of counsel table, right? Remember those days before COVID?
I do.
Yeah, it was horrible, right? And now you can do them all by video, right? So it would have been possible if someone objected at the time for someone to call the victim and say, are you able to get on video for a second and do this? I don't know. Maybe she would have said, no, I'm too traumatized. I can't do it. But at least at that moment in time, something could have happened. No one did that. And now, after the fact, everyone's saying, she didn't show up. She didn't show up, even though they thought they maybe had enough evidence to revoke based on the DNA, the videos, the probation agent IDing, the fact that he had a cigarette, the fact that that many of the descriptions that she gave of the sexual assault matched the same descriptions of him in the video on the porch, the fact that she submitted to a sexual assault nurse exam, she got the cameras. I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but that's most of it, I think. But all of that, but no one ever said, why don't you just call her up? I mean, maybe she could even testified by phone, and that would have been okay, but no one did that. So it's just sort of frustrating here. Everyone's kind of putting their hands up and saying, like, I don't know, not my problem, and so, but it's our problem.
Sure. Well, I understand your concern. I guess I'd just say that, well, there is no forfeiture requirement, again, in revocation hearings, no body of law in forfeiture and revocation hearings that I'm aware of. It was, after all, the duty of the department to call the witness. I think the department just made a mistake here. They could have used.
I don't know. I don't know if that's fair. I mean, I don't know that it's fair to say they made a mistake not calling a sexual assault victim who, when the agent said we didn't want to re-traumatize her.
Well, they could have called the officers who arrived on the scene immediately after the alleged assault, which probably would have been admissible as excited utterance statements made to the officers. They could have done a number of things. They're in Section HA 2.055 of the Administrative Code. That section is designed to give the hearing examiner broad powers in protecting vulnerable witnesses. They could have asked the victim if she had a problem testifying. There's no evidence on the record that they did that. This sounds like just a unilateral decision from the agent.
No one brought it up as an issue. I'll let it go.
Counsel, I had asked you two questions, perhaps unfairly, and you very fairly addressed the second one first, and then my colleagues continued on that line. But I want to go back to my question about hearsay and its reliability, going back to footnote 6 in Simpson, a revocation decision can be based entirely on hearsay. It's sufficient to prove a probation violation so long as the hearsay is reliable. Here we have a situation where we have non-hearsay evidence that corroborates the hearsay evidence. Could you respond to the argument that that is sufficient to require the consideration of that evidence in this case?
Well, sure, and I guess I'd say two things about that. First of all, if the division had made that decision, if they'd relied on the hearsay, that might also have been a very reasonable decision. I guess I'd just point out that opposing counsel mentioned that in Simpson, the ALJ's decision was reviewed and the court found reason on the record to support that decision as reasonable. In this case, it's, due respect, I'd say the court's duty is to search the record to find whether or not there's evidence that would make the division's ultimate decision in this case a reasonable decision, even if it's not the one that this court might have come to.
And I've conducted that analysis, and that's where I'm struggling with the reasonableness of the decision in light of what I think is reliable hearsay evidence corroborated by evidence that was not, and very probative evidence from my review, that wasn't discussed here by the agency. And again, I agree with the argument that there is no need to itemize every piece of evidence that was considered, but when it's such compelling evidence, when it's DNA evidence, when it's evidence, the video evidence that corroborates what the victim said in a hearsay report, I think there's a legal obligation to address that evidence in order for the determination to be deemed a reasonable one by this court.
May I answer briefly?
You may.
The issue, I think, is that the balancing test is between the defendant's due process interest and, on the other side, the difficulty, expense, and other problems that the state had in producing the witness, also examining the reliability of the evidence. The evidence here, I think, has at least some reliability problems. I think it would have been valuable. The defendant had an interest in questioning the victim about whether there were any other facts that might make him more likely or less likely as a suspect. And the balancing takes place when the department made no effort to bring the victim in to testify. You balance that against the due process interest held by Mr. Sellers, and I think it's at least a reasonable conclusion that the due process interest went out in that calculation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rappel.
In rebuttal, I have three main points. They all relate to record sites that I think will be useful to the court. The first two address the forfeiture issue directly. So this is record 8 at 138. This is Sellers' attorney, what she said verbatim regarding the victim not testifying. Quote, "I understand completely why the department did not have the victim testify in this case," end quote. Second thing is record 8 at 69 and 71. That is Sellers' objection, written objection, or appeal to DHA. Doesn't mention good cause, doesn't mention the victim not testifying. Third record site is the police report excerpt that I mentioned earlier in colloquy with Justice Krofsky. Record 8 at 36 through 38. This is the police report excerpt the day after, the morning after, the security camera footage was shot when Keo Sellers returned to the porch and trespassed. It's Officer Walker, who is the officer that testified at the revocation hearing, his police report saying that he talked to the victim And I think this goes to whether there was consent to with regard to the trespass. So again, those sites are R8 at 138. That's the direct quote from Attorney Rausch saying that she understood completely why the victim wasn't testifying. R8 69 through 71 is Sellers' appeal, and then R8 36 through 38 is the police report excerpt that Sellers' counsel submitted.
Given that we review the DHA decision, I guess I'm struggling to understand why that matters. We're reviewing a determination based upon the collection of evidence of what actually happened at the hearing. And Mr. Sellers is now defending his victory by the decision maker, which was not ALJ in the situation. It's DHA for our purposes. So I don't understand why he would have forfeited the opportunity to defend the decision that was made by the department that's under review.
Well, the DHA had that same record before it, and it could have read that exact quote that I read. So
I know, but it didn't. So we don't, I mean, why do I, we're reviewing the DHA decision. We're not reviewing what the ALJ did.
Correct. So I think that it's very important, though, to respect the principle of party presentation. It's not just forfeiture, but it's that Sellers didn't present this argument. And if you look at the footnote in the Court of Appeals decision, that is a very problematic footnote. And I'm talking about the footnote where it addressed forfeiture and said, well, yeah, like Sellers didn't raise it, but we're reviewing DHA's decision, so it doesn't matter. I think that is wrong. That is wrong. We are reviewing DHA's decision, but the forfeiture does matter because of the principle of party presentation. And courts and administrative tribunals don't make arguments for parties. They don't make up the arguments. That's what DHA did. That's why this is problematic.
Counsel, assuming that there is no law, administrative rule, or developed in decisions regarding forfeiture, what are the consequences of this court embracing a forfeiture requirement or application, if you will, to revocation hearings? I'm concerned that there might be a substantial increase in litigation if that kind of...
I think that's a realistic concern, that there could be a substantial increase in litigation. It's speculative, but if
what
the court...
What do you think would be the consequence of adopting it?
Well, I think the consequence would be the message would be clear what needs to be happening at these hearings.
And what's the consequence in terms of, what's your best guess? I mean, you deal with this stuff more than I do. What's your best guess of the consequence in terms of the increase in litigation? Much? Nothing much at all? Don't worry? Cascade?
Whenever people say cascade, I'm dubious. So I don't think cascade. I think that there could be more cases, but I'd really be speculating about that.
Whose burden is it at the hearing?
It's the state's burden to prove
right,
these
so
allegations.
Let's say you have a trial and I had a trial once where the state never proved venue and I had to dismiss a count. Why would and then let's say later on that comes up. I mean, this is a very, I'm just making the analogy to show that why would the defendant have to object to the state not doing their job? The state has the burden. So I don't understand where you would even get how this is the responsibility of Mr. Sellers in any way, shape, or form.
May I answer the question, Chief Justice? Not only, it's a big problem because not only was there no objection, there was an acquiescence. The quote I read is an acquiescence. It's not just a failure to object. It's,
they said they didn't understand?
That's said, I understand completely why the department did not have the victim testify in this case. We ask you to reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We are adjourned. The court will convene in closed conference at 1:45.